Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Hello and welcome back to the FT Arts Podcast. I'm Jan Daly, the FT's Arts Editor, and I'm delighted to be joined this week by Louis de Bernier, author most famously of Captain Corelli's Mandolin, as well as many other novels, by the playwright Mike Packer and journalist Carl Wilkinson. We'll be discussing literary adaptations. Of the five nominees for Best Film at the BAFTAs, three were based on novels, and at the Oscars later this month, six of the nine movies up for Best Picture are adaptations. This year also sees a rich crop, including Anna Karenina, other classics, as well as many other modern novels, making it onto the big screen. Now, have they always been so popular? Or are filmmakers playing it safe in uncertain times? How do you go about writing an adaptation? And how does it feel to see your novel or play on the big screen? Louis, thank you for joining us. Your novel Red Dog, based on the true story of a dog who roamed Western Australia in the 1970s, was made into a film last year. It was a big hit at the Australian box office and opens in the UK this week. Is it a good adaptation?
It's an exceptionally good adaptation. It's one of the few cases where the film really is, I think, better than the book. And I don't say that willingly. I wrote it originally for children, and so I suppose you could say the characterization wasn't all that developed in the book. But in the film, the characters are much more well-developed, and it's a very lively, joyful, and also sad film. I mean, my four-year-old daughter loved it, and I loved it too, and I'm 57, so...
I really enjoyed it, actually.
Did you?
I did. I watched it over the weekend. I really enjoyed it. Was it developed by the director and the screenwriter? How much did you have to do with it, Louis?
I had nothing to do with the script writing. I was a bit miffed that they didn't ask me. But having said that, whoever the scriptwriter was did a better job than I could.
Perhaps you need that distance.
I think you actually really needed to be an Australian.
Ah, yes, there
that's
is that.
What I saw when I watched it, you really felt that it was made by Australians, and the whole culture and the characters, and that really pinged out to me that if you know the culture of the people that you're writing about and the places, that once you've got that on screen, then it lives.
Well, it sounds to me as if the adaptation of Red Dog was a happier experience for you as a writer than the adaptation of Captain Corelli, because I'm going to quote something that you said, a lovely thing in a Lunch with the FT interview a few years ago. You said, compared to a novel, a film is like an economy pizza where there are no olives, no ham, no anchovies, no mushrooms, and all you've got is the dough. I don't know if you even remember saying that or if you were accurately quoted, but perhaps Captain Corelli was not such a happy experience, was it?
It was a happy experience in many ways. I thought that there were some mistakes by the director. For example, one of the sad things about the book is that the couple don't become lovers until they're very old. And in the film, there was a completely gratuitous sex scene in the middle in an olive grove, after which Captain Corelli just disappears for a while. And I thought he somehow missed the point of the book. But having said that, you know, the performances by John Hurt and David Morrissey were fantastically good. I thought the soundtrack was magnificent, the one by Stephen Warbeck. The whole film would have been worth it for the soundtrack, to be honest. The cinematography was amazing. And I just was totally thrilled to meet Penelope Cruz and find out that she's as sweet in real life as she is on film.
Oh, well, that's
so. I can't say the film was a total disappointment. No,
and it was a huge success, and it's become a famous film. So, your bit of authorial needle, I suppose, has to in the end be subsumed.
I think there's an awful problem with films if you are a writer, which is, and actually if you are a reader too, which is, if you have written a book or read it, you've already made your own movie in your own mind. And you know what everybody looks like, what they sound like. You know the landscape, even though you've never been there, for example. And when you see the film, it's completely different from the movie you had made in your own head. That's why you feel uncomfortable. And I would recommend to anybody, actually, to see the film first and then read the book.
Mike, your play, The Dysfunctionals, a great hit at the Bush Theatre in London in 2007 and is currently at the Sovremennik Theatre in Moscow, translated into Russian, and now you are turning it into a film. Can you tell me about its transition from one language to another and from stage to screen?
Wow. From one language to another is... Well, I've just been there to watch the play in Russian. The whole experience is completely different because Russian theatre is very, very different. They have 7 months to rehearse, for instance, whereas you have 4 weeks at the Bush. The resources they have are enormous compared to the kind of resources you get at the Bush. But also, theatre means something different. In theatre in time and place, when it all comes together, like it seems to have done in Moscow, it has a greater meaning. And at the moment, that play in Moscow seems to have a greater meaning within the whole context of their society. So that's been a wonderful experience. The experience of turning a play into a screenplay has been interesting.
You've written your own screenplay.
I have now. I have.
Ah, does that mean somebody else did it to start with?
Well, no, I wouldn't let go of it was the problem. And I don't know how that's going to end. Because initially, a lot of film companies were interested in buying it. And so I had meetings with, you know, major players in the industry. And I was, you know, desperate for the money, for a start, and to get the film made. And then you meet people and you think they can do what they want with it initially. And then when they start to tell you what they want to do with it, yeah. I found it absolutely impossible to let go.
I could have got a massive deal on Red Dog by selling it to somebody who wanted to move the story to the USA. And I just couldn't do it. I'm sorry, it's got to be in Australia.
Yeah, this is the thing. So my play was about a punk rock band who reformed to do an advert for an American credit card company. And the first question that came at me from one of these Hollywood executives was, first of all, no swearing. You're allowed one swear word, which is you're allowed to say the F word once. Because they want it to be a 15 certificate, which is, you know, there's... I'm not as bothered about that as a lot of people seem to be, although it is a punk rock band and they're in their 50s and it is about that. But then they said, and can it be a new romantic band as opposed to a punk band? And once you get there, you're going, well, the thing is that it's about being against consumerism and... Mm. Selling yourself, and that's what punk was kind of about. And so if you change it to new romantic, and before you knew it was going to be something entirely different. So so you know, I had a few meetings like that, and some people are honest, aren't they, and some people are dishonest about what they want to do with it. So
you're lucky you didn't get asked for a car chase and an abduction by aliens.
I'm sure that was coming. You know, that's the hilarity of it. It's that journey.
Carl, you wrote a piece for the FT on literary adaptations recently. Why do you think they're so popular right now?
Well, I think there's sort of two issues here. One is just pure happenstance. I mean, there are an awful lot of films coming out this year. And as you said, at the Oscars, you know, you've got The Descendants, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, The Help, Hugo, Moneyball and War Horse are all in contention for Best Film. Why there are so many at the moment? Well, a lot of those films have been in development for years. And so I think there's just, you know, it's like buses. Several have come along at once for no good reason. But I think there is something sort of beyond that that is to do with our connection with stories as an audience and what it is that speaks to us, but also from the industry point of view, what it is that makes a good film. And you know, if you're an investor or a producer, you're just basically looking for a really good story that that will make a good film, and you don't care where it comes from, you know, and if it's a novel.
So a proven success is important, is an important place to start.
I think so. But I mean, as Stephen Daldry said to me, the number of people who've read most of these big literary novels could fill a restaurant. You know, that's not going to pay your £25 million budget for a film. So I think there's something beyond just purely an initial audience of people who've read the book. I think there's something to do with sort of cultural currency. I think, you know, a film like Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which has sort of been panned actually by critics, had kind of literary cachet, and I think it was bought before it was actually published. And so, you know, there's a kind of an audience there that would just want to see the film but haven't read it.
I think producers are like everyone else. If they read a good book, well, they're not like everyone else because not everyone else is a producer, but like everyone else, they enjoy reading a book. And if they happen to read one which they think would make a good film, then they'll go for it. I imagine it's much harder to get a script to a producer because it's not something they're going to be doing for pleasure. That's work, isn't it? Or is it, if they read a book on an aeroplane because they're having a long journey, then they might think, oh, this will make a good film.
Well, the number of stories you hear about producers in summer houses in the Hamptons or in Greece or wherever who happen to have picked up an old battered paperback of something.
Exactly.
And thought, oh, this will make a good film, you know.
Yes, yeah, so this Jane Austen, who is her agent.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Now, what about the economics of adaptations? I mean, do you think that it's actually easier to find investors for adaptations than it is for original scripts?
I think at the moment it's difficult to find investors in films in general. And they say at the moment, in the British film industry anyway, that very few films are being made over a budget of £3 million, which is really, really small. So, and in fact, most films that are being made now in the last year or are projected to be made are like £2 million quid. So that's a whole new ball game of the way you're going to make a film. And that's why the new technology and digital cameras and smaller crews and a different type of script is now possibly going to be the way forward in the next couple of years, because the model for making money is kind of bust at the moment because DVD sales have disappeared and they haven't yet found a way to make money out of live streaming and downloading from the internet.
This must be why you weren't offered a car chase and you couldn't afford it.
Car chase, you're not, in fact, every kind of big thing that is in a film at the moment, people are trying to get rid of. So it's question is the baby thrown out with the bathwater? We're about to find out over the next few years.
I think often that a low budget makes a better film. And when Captain Corelli's Mandolin was being filmed, they were simultaneously filming Bridget Jones's Diary, which was on a far, far lower budget and is probably a better film.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you that you're more likely to get a film that is from a kind of single voice or the voice of the actual people making the film on a small budget. The bigger the budget, the more input everybody has from the first producer to the next producers to the people putting money in all the way down the line.
I think that's exactly the point, that a low-budget film is likely to be the product of one genius, whereas a big-budget film has half a dozen producers who want different things from it.
And it forces a kind of forces you to address what the actual story is and tell it sort of as clearly as possible, rather than sort of throwing everything in because you can afford to.
I guess
you sort of you kind of have to think about what the story is that you really want to tell.
What have been some of your favourite, I mean, all-time favourites of literary adaptations? We can go back a long way. Anna Karenina, for example, was being done again in 2012 with an adaptation by Tom Stoppard, I think. Yeah. Has it been done since the very old one? There was one in the 70s,
yeah,
was
I think
there?
There's been about six or possibly seven adaptations. I think one of them was a Russian TV miniseries. I mean, I guess the problem with Anna Karenina is that it's, you know, sort of a 900-page novel that you have to boil down to 120 pages and of script. And so that really does force the screenwriter or the adapter to kind of try and work out what the core story is. And I think what Stoppard's doing is his sort of thesis is that the book and his film will be about love. And so, as I understand it, everything that didn't fit that central thesis, he's just chucked out. And I think you do have to be kind of ruthless, but you do also have to kind of try and understand what the core story is.
You can do sensible things to a story without ruining it. I mean, I've just written two versions of the script for Birds Without Wings, which is my next big novel. And in that book, I had two characters going to different theatres of war. And the obvious thing to do to economise on effort was to have them both going off to the same theatre of war together. It didn't materially alter the story, but it would make the whole thing easier to do. You can come up with tricks like that.
And was that something that was suggested to you by producers? Or
yes,
did you
it was suggested to me by the producer, yes. Mm.
But that you didn't mind. So this time you're doing your own script. Are you finding that rewarding or difficult or...?
It's very rewarding. I love doing it. But the thing that I've learned from it is that novelists are very, shall we say, logocentric. They're wordy. What they like is words. What movie makers like is pictures. So if you're a literary writer who's writing a script, you have to bear in mind all the time that it's something that's being seen as well as heard.
Well, playwrights know that. Naturally, though, don't they? Because you, as a playwright, you have to do both things anyway, don't you? You have to have the visual image in your mind, presumably, when you're actually writing your play. You're making, as you say, you're making the movie, you're producing it in your mind.
You do, but there's still a leap to making a screenplay. And it's still a big leap. It's a different leap to the leap from novel to screen. And so, you know, I've sat and watched hundreds and hundreds of films that have been made out of plays, and you see a pattern and you watch the pattern, but ultimately you've kind of got to reinvent it in your mind as you're writing it, and kind of hopefully keep that central story and the central feeling and meaning and drive, but tell it in a way that's visual.
Yeah, for example, in a film, you will often have long panning shots of the landscape and maybe a little shot of an eagle above a mountain. You can't do that in a play. So the playwright has still got to, as you say, make a substantial leap.
And a lot of things can be expressed in words on stage that sometimes you can do with a look, and you can do with a picture of somebody alone, as opposed to, you know, a soliloquy or something like that. There's just millions of different things that you have to look at to change, and it's very hard to keep the essence of the thing while you're doing that.
Any particular favourite adaptations, Mike?
My favourite adaptation probably is my favourite film, which is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Ah, yes.
Which is different to the book, but I think keeps the essence of what Ken Casey was about.
Yeah, that's a great example. Louis, what would you...
I can think of dozens of examples, but the one that always springs to mind when people ask this is Zorba the Greek.
Oh!
Because the book is very largely a rather depressing account of somebody's difficult relationship with God, which you wouldn't really make a great film out of. But what the film did was take this wonderful character, Zorba, and transfer the focus to him. And, you know, it might be the origin of my love affair with Greece, in fact, that film.
Well, we have a lot to thank you. Yes, Zorba's responsible for a lot in all sorts of ways, I think. That's a very good example, because I'm not sure I was even aware that there was a book. I've certainly never read it. And so also a good example of a film that's stronger than the book on which it was based, do you think?
The film is much stronger on narrative. The book is obviously much stronger on thoughtfulness.
Carl, any favourites?
I don't know about favourites. I watched The Great Gatsby again the other day, the 1974 version, I think it is, with Robert Redford. And that's quite interesting because it feels very 70s. It has this sort of slightly washed out, kind of almost like Vaseline on the lens, kind of soft focus. And it, you know, it's sort of gloriously sort of rich and sort of lavish, and in some parts very true to the novel. And, of course, the Gatsby is being remade this year. So it'll be very interesting to see. I think it's Baz Luhrmann who's doing it, who obviously did Romeo and Juliet, which was a fabulous reworking of Shakespeare's play. And it'll be interesting to see what he then manages to do and whether he manages to make it sort of our times.
We've only got a minute left, but can you name any really bad ones that you think haven't worked?
I think there are hundreds, but... I was asking my 10-year-old this morning, which was, I was saying, I've got to go in and maybe pick one that I really didn't like, and he said The Cat in the Hat, which apparently is appalling, but I've not seen it myself, so that's his one.
Any that you'd like to single out that, not that necessarily were bad films, but that just weren't successful as adaptations?
The only one I can think of at the moment is Great Expectations, which obviously gets remade pretty much on an annual basis. And it was with Gwyneth Paltrow and Ethan Hawke. And it was a real howler. I mean, dire.
Well, on that note, I wish you huge success with both your projects. Thank you so much for coming. And I'm afraid we're out of time. Red Dog is out in the UK on the 24th of February. And a big thank you to Louis Debenier, Mike Packer and Carl Wilkinson. And to you all for listening. The Arts Podcast was produced by Griselda Murray-Brown.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.